Barbara, thank you so much, and welcome everybody. It's great to see some new faces and familiar ones as well. Often when we do talks on incarceration and health, we have a mixed audience, and I'm just going to ask if those of you have worked in or are familiar with jails particularly, yeah? And those who are more familiar with prison services, so yeah. And those from the East Coast who are worried about people who are wet, with trees falling in their yards, and those of you from the this coast, yeah. So nice, and we've got it all, and we're still worried, and we're all worried, and yet the Giants won last night, and we got to be here for that. So, what could you do? Life is a journey. So. Let's see. So I guess the health outcomes from a study that we did to look at a model that was created some time back about 5 years ago. And I have no financial relationships or other conflicts to disclose. I do want to share that, in fact, this data was put together by our local evaluator, Paul Teixeira, who is home and is not here, so if anybody has any interest in the granularity of the data about t-tests or chi-squares, I encourage you to email him or call him, and I'm happy to provide that contact information. So my purpose here is to give you a little bit of an overview of what we did and some of the very recent and findings. So just for those of you who are unaware, Rikers Island has 9 operating jail facilities. We have 90 to 100,000 incarcerations each year, and I don't know, over 12,000 people are there today, where Dr. Venters has stayed behind to make sure that the medical care is taken care of, and we are wishing he was with us, but glad he's taking care, so we could be here today with you all. So just as a little bit of a background, we started looking at the intersection between correctional health and jail health early in the Bloomberg administration, and I was able to show that, in fact, 70% of folks coming out of jail were returning to the same zip code in the city where we had the greatest socioeconomic disparities, where we were creating district public health offices, and where the highest rates of pick a chronic disease, are found. And so we say correctional health is public health. Just as a little background, we have about 78,000 medical visits each month. We have provided over 13,000 discharge plans for mentally ill people in 2011. We did over 2,500 folks who were HIV infected in jails received a discharge plan, and then others who are at risk of HIV and have other chronic health conditions, we have been able to provide about 1,500 discharge plans. That was in 2011. And we are happy to let you all know that we are using electronic health records now, so when people are transferred, as they are every 15 minutes or so, from one facility to another, their health record follows with them, and we're no longer counting the boxes of loose paper. So working from jails is a challenge. Anybody who's worked in one knows the short stays are the norm. We never really know whether someone's coming or going, whether they're going to be with us for a day or two or longer. And so we're always working with one of two possibilities. Either the person will stay or they will leave. And we make a plan for both options. And when one or the other happens, then we move forward. So we're working with self-reports. We start discharge planning with people based on what they report to us, as you would in a community setting. We're not waiting for lab results to come back. We're just working with what we're presented with, and that is a challenge, nevertheless. And we are looking forward to health information exchanges and other ways of sharing data with our community partners, and you can be sure that those of us on the panel work together very closely on a day-by-day with our patients. So this is the continuum of care model. It shows that there are services that are provided during the jail stay that help prepare folks for when they may leave, as well as take care of their health needs during their stay in jail. We have what I'm referring to is transitional care coordination services that includes discharge planning, medications that people are provided so that when they leave they have bridge medication from jail until they get to the community providers for that medication continuity. Patient navigation happens both from our own direct service staff as well as community partner organizations that are funded to do that kind of work, as well as care coordination. And then our community partners who are providing medical care, case management, and navigation to facilitate that continuity of care. So we were very fortunate to be one of 10 demonstration sites selected to study our model of HIV continuum of care from the HRSA Special Projects of National Significance. And you can see we are the big blue dot in the middle of the world, so apparently size matters. And so we did work together as a group to identify facilitators and barriers. I say establish relationships and remove barriers to facilitate linkages to care. But the thing about this was each site had different focus. So, for example, Chicago and one other site worked exclusively with women, so their number is lower, but it's not because they had fewer people. It was just they were looking at something a little bit different, right? So each site, comparing it, the Evaluation Center had quite a job, and I'm sure Ann Spaulding would be happy to share with you how they went about doing that with APT Associates, but I think the expression a little like herding cats is over used these days, but I'm pretty sure it would be appropriate here. So we enrolled folks now. In New York City, our criteria were a little bit different, like I said, than the other sites, and I am focusing here exclusively on the local evaluation for New York. If you look at the system-wide numbers from New York that are in the multi-site evaluation, just those of you who are familiar with this data, know that we have a little bit of a higher end here because we continue to enroll people a little bit past the time frame for the multi-site evaluation. And while the multi-site evaluation followed folks for 6 months, we actually have been following folks for a year, though that data is we'll have to see you next year. So we had a baseline survey. It's an 18-page questionnaire. There were optional modules we did not opt for. I do have the questionnaire here if you want to see it. And then we did jail chart reviews that collected clinical information. The post-release services was the document we used to determine that someone was linked to primary care post-release. And then the six-month follow-up looks very much like the baseline survey with, you know, modifications because it was hopefully after release. So the first slide shows the jail demographics. For the participants in the jail linkages study. And they look very much like our Rikers Island population, both at baseline and at six-month follow-up. The women are overrepresented in the study, and that's because women are overrepresented as HIV positive. There's more women who are infected with HIV than men proportionately, significantly, and also because we had very ambitious staff in the women's facility who are very good at enrolling participants. So the health histories, I think of education as a health indicator, and the health industry, the mean values for what's represented here. Now we do find a difference in heroin use that we think is significant, which is why it's supposed to be highlighted a little. And also a history of methadone. And the other thing that's not shown here, but something that we've been looking at, is there seems to be a difference in lifetime years of heroin use, where longer-term users seem to be more likely to be seen at follow-up as those who were not. And we think this warrants further study. The staff said to us they think that people may just get sick and tired of the life, so it wasn't so much the year how old they were, but how many years they'd been addicted. So something to think about. And the other significant difference between the baseline group who were seen primarily in jail and were all seen in jail, and the six-month follow-up folks is that there's more psychiatric distress for the population that we're talking to while they're in jail. Go figure. So So now this is to show the improvements over time for the participants who were seen for a follow-up visit. That is that they completed the six-month survey. And we think that all of these changes were statistically significant, and Paul can explain about the probabilities, but everything is pretty clear that we were looking at differences that were substantial and significant. So, for example, folks based on this seem to have been not taking antiretroviral therapy in the 7 days before medication, before incarceration. At 63% were taking them, and 95% at the six-month follow-up. Similarly, there were only 86% of folks who were ever on ART before incarceration, and we were able to get them to start taking ART treatment during their jail stay, and that continued post-release in the community. Similarly, folks self-reported being adherent about 80% of the time. We had a little readiness ruler kind of thing. And almost 95% reported that way post-release, which is what we're looking for clinically. Then the principal investigator of this local evaluation was interested in what else are we doing in terms of changing and saving lives, and so I wanted to know what happened with the reported average of emergency department visits in the 6 months prior to jail, and then what happened 6 months later. And we found that it declined by 20%. So, and there was one, and similarly, then what happened in terms of getting people housing, because the staff make plans for folks that address their basic needs in order to get them to the doctor, because as it turns out, you can't get folks to show up to the doctor if they don't have boot clothing and shelter. So each of our staff were looking at the outcome of getting people to primary care, but they knew in order for that to happen, the barriers to getting to the doctor had to be removed. So transportation, accompaniment, escort, literally socks and underwear. So we were really pleased to see that we actually had reduced the number of folks who said that they had been homeless in the 30 days, that, you know, self-reported at any time in the 30 days prior to the six-month survey, and that had gone down significantly from what they had said before they came into jail, which was almost 27%. And the finding that the staff, I think, are most, we all get sort of chills when we think about the number of folks who said that they had two or more days out of the last 30 where they had nothing or barely anything to eat, dropped from 25% to less than 2%. So people came into jail, got on medication, went out, stayed on medication, felt better, stopped using the emergency room, and had housing. Similarly, the clinical outcomes were looked at for the folks that we were able to follow from baseline. And this does compare the averages. Paul did some paired T-tests to compare these two things, and for those of you who want to know how he did that, you should let him know, and he'll let you know. But Paul Teixeira, like the Met pitcher, the Yankee pitcher. Sorry, now I'm blasphemy on the tape. So the other thing that we wanted to then say, because you know we shared these findings in a number of settings, including NCCHC. There was a poster and some other locations, and folks said, well, that's great, Allison, for the folks that you were able to follow for 6 months, but aren't the folks that you followed for 6 months more likely to be compliant? And so, you know, aren't your findings skewed because you're looking at people who were willing to fill out an 18-page questionnaire who were more likely to be engaged and otherwise, you know, compliant? And so we said, oh. And in fact, the health department, because, right, I mean, it looks great. So, undetectable viral loads doubled. The number of people with undetectable, the percentage of folks that we were able to see doubled, right? So, way cool. So, because this here, I say this is saving lives, saving money, right? Brad's like, yeah, no brainer. So what we did was we actually went to the HIV/AIDS registry, which is run by the New York City Health Department and receives the clinical information for all of the city as a whole. And that's increased over time. First it was just AIDS, then it moved into folks with HIV and opportunistic infections, and now we have a lot of information that's coming into the registry on a client level basis. So we were able to actually, well, we didn't, but the people who go in the room with the doors closed were able to match client by client, line by line, the folks who were not seen by us for the 18-page survey, but were seen by their doctors in the community. And so we were able to get the CD4 and viral load information for each of those folks, and then what you see here is mean, because it's not reported back to us on a line by line. We get it in a totals. So when you look at, this is just a depiction of the CD4 counts comparing the group at the top are the folks that completed our survey, and the blue, darker blue underneath it are the folks who did not complete the survey but had CD4 counts taken. And so you can see they're pretty close. I mean, there's some differences, interesting stuff we could talk about when I have more time. And then similarly, the viral load. So there's like this middle group where it's a little wonky, but at the top and the bottom, they're pretty comparable. So essentially what we were able to do is not only see the folks that we knew about, but also have a little bit of a window to the folks that we didn't know about, in ways that I think are pretty exciting for us as a health public health entity. And we hope that this will continue to give us other ways of looking at other parts of the amount of data. I can't even tell you, 5 years, it's like maddening that it's out there. I'm just trying to call it out. It's very exciting. So what else? So I think one of the most important things I have to say is that the folks who were followed, for example, we thought the women were going to be sicker than the men, because we see women who are sick, and the women have different issues. It's mostly sex work and drugs, and so we thought that the women's outcomes clinically would be worse than the men, and they weren't. They were either the same or, in fact, better for the CD4 and viral load. So we're looking at that as sort of what happened. And the only thing I have so far, one of the things we were talking about is that the case manager and the relationship between the patient and the case manager seems to really matter. I have one provider and they had this very sort of average, but then when we looked at the percentage of linkages to care by one case manager versus another case manager, they were 20 percentage points apart. And so I think it matters that you hire the right folks, which gives me an opportunity to thank Jackie, who was a project office, the program coordinator on this, the team leaders, our data crunchers, our bosses, Amanda Parson, Homer Venters, Louise Cohen, and the folks that keep the money flowing. So they always get left out, but Eric Zimmel is, without Eric, I don't have staff, I don't have computers. And Paul wanted to especially thank Sarah Brownstein and DePaul Shaw, who helped us with getting the HARS data so that we could actually even look at it. How cool. And then, of course, our colleagues in the Jails Linkages Project and the SPINS leadership, who've been really, really awesome. And so if you have any questions, I have, a minute and a half to take them? So one question, I guess, we get. Thank you very much. So, go ahead. I think I can take one question. You have one question. So Brad's sat in the front. He gets the question.
For dropping EDUs, food stability, and homelessness, you're running the best program in the world and solve these amazing problems. I mean, that's the piece of the answer. The HIV work is across SPINS.
So the thing is that we just don't let go, right? So the point is that it's not just about getting folks into the doctor. If you want folks to get to the doctor, you have to take care of food, clothing, shelter, and you have to hire people who care about folks. You have to have folks who understand and are non-judgmental about the lives that our patient population leaves, which are less than you know, multifaceted, multi-problemed. And I don't actually, you know, it wasn't something that we anticipated. It was just a question out of a lot of questions in an 18-page survey. But I thought it you know, it is telling a story that I think health homes might benefit from, and from, you know, from the point of view that, you know, folks, it costs a lot of money to provide discharge planning services, particularly accompaniment and escorts. People go crazy when I tell them what that costs. But if you're looking at that in the context of reducing homeless shelter stays and emergency department visits and, who knows, maybe hospitalizations, it's hard because of the sickness of the population, then I think, you know, saving lives, saving money, everybody should be doing discharge planning. Thanks for the puff ball.